I want to talk about the place on the tongue of each vowel sound and why each is exactly where it is. So we said that about a third of the way back from the tip of the tongue, I didn't give you all the details last time, but now I'm going to give you the details. About a third of the way back from the tip of the tongue, so as it would be about here, is the E sound. And the way you find the E sound, which you can find for yourself right now, is put the tip of your tongue behind the lower teeth. Okay, very easily. And you have four front teeth, right? 1, 2, 3, 4. Where the first and the four teeth are, if you were to draw a line across those teeth, that would be approximately the E place. Mm-hmm. You don't have to be accurate, but it gives you a sense of what I'm talking about. So it would go E, and then a little bit after, behind that, is the I place, as in sit. A little bit behind that is the A place, as in set. After that comes the A place, as in sat or cat. Then we get the A sound. Now that takes place in the middle of the tongue, and it goes A, as in mud. I'll repeat these enough for you so that you'll know them. And then the next vowel sound that we're concerned with in this pattern is the R sound. And that we have to be very careful of because it's the last, it tends to drop back. So it goes R across from one side to the other. R as in father. All right. Let me repeat that. E, I, E, ah. Right. Now, when I said e, I, e, a, and ah, what I have in my mind is a line that goes across the tongue from one end to the other. From one side, it goes like this. E. That's the thought that I want you to picture that in your mind. E, going from this side across to this side. We won't do anything yet because I want to explain this whole concept to you totally first. It goes across because the sound E easily and comfortably goes across the entire blade if you imagine it to do so. And so you can take in all of those vibrations. See, it just gives you more vibrations when you think of it going across from one side to the other. I'm going, for an example, to not go across from this side to that. And let's see what happens. I'm going to think of the E sort of in the middle of the tongue. E. Did you feel it? Could you almost see that it was in the middle of the tongue? And yet, it was missing. Something's missing. But if I think from one side to the other, I'm going to get E. You feel it? It took in all of that area for vibrations. That's me. Now, every vowel works on that principle except a. So it would go e, e, a, a. Now, I'm going to try to do that with a. It does not work. Don't ask me why. It doesn't work. Listen to how it works best. E, 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 a, a. Do you feel it? Mm-hmm. It has its strength, and then can go back to side to side. Eleanor McClellan, who was the creator of this concept of speech and song, who passed it on to Alice Rowe, who was my teacher, was a woman of enormous knowledge about the voice and about singing and about speaking. She included everything into her technique. She used yoga techniques, the Alexander method. She used every kind in addition to her phenomenal understanding of the voice and of speaking. She worked with a very famous singer, Eileen Farrell. Have you heard of her name? Aha, uh-huh. Well, she was Eileen Farrell's teacher. I'm surprised that you know that name.
Yeah,
yeah, I thought that would have been of the 40s and that...
Well, I'm not
The 30s and 40s, exactly. That's swell. I'm glad I mentioned it. Good. Come sit over here, because what did I want to do? What I'd like you to understand. The other day, I understood something, and I want to convey it to you. I also want to say that when Yen Lu will form a class, it will be on Saturdays, and I have signed you up, period, because you need it. I really want you to take it. I took that workshop, and I really understood, because we do it in class, what they do, what Yen Lu and her mentor, Irmgard Bartanief, I think it's pronounced, are working on. So it's really an extension of the work that we do, but it's very, very beautiful. And it will serve you, and it will serve Ruth, because it opens you from the inside. Do you remember when, one of the times when I was directing the Orestes, and I said, David, you don't turn from the outside, you turn from in. It's exactly what they teach. It's what they call a rotation. I used two words now that I got from Irmgard this morning, which is sequence and rotation. And when you think of sequence, which is an ongoing connection through the whole body, it gives you a sense of beauty, see, and a unified quality. When you think of rotation, you move from the inside, right? So you move this way, or you move that way. You can tell that I'm moving from an inside sense of myself. Okay, I'd like you to think today of the body being in two. Probably one would say the body, there are three bodies. One would say the astral body, but that's not anything that I'm, connected to. So I can't talk about that one if it exists. I'm sure it does. Then there is what I call this outside body, okay? And that's the outline of that body. Then I would like you to think that there is a body within that body, okay? And it's that movement that I want you to work from. Like that, and like that. Now, up at the very top of the spine is the occipital, right? So I want you to think of that. This has the occipital. This is the outside part of the reach, okay? Then there's the spine that goes like so. See? And then there is at the bottom of the torso, all of the inner organs, okay? I want you to have the idea that these inner organs are not locked into the outer body, but they are swaying somewhat. I don't know quite the right word to use for it. They're on a trampoline or a waterbed. Am I giving you the right idea?
That's what they are anyway. They're floating in fluids, right?
I guess they are. See, that's how much I know, right? but God, you're right in line with the lessons. God, you're doing okay, Creator. I approve of... So, yes. All right. So let's take that waterbed idea, and let's feel that instead of, and I'm going to show you what I mean by in myself, that instead of sitting, give me your hand, instead of sort of feel that sitting on myself, which means I lock in all of the tension. Now I'm going to remove myself on the inside, and I'm going to be on floating on that waterbed, and I'm going to be on the trampoline. Mm-hmm. And what I've done with my imagination, I have lifted this whole section of myself so that it's really doing this inside the frame. So it's like a box within a box, mm-hmm. and that inner box is exquisitely placed on satin, the most exquisite satin fabric. mm-hmm. I hate to think of a coffin just now. I don't mean to talk about coffins. But let's say a Chinese box within a box. Or this world on the inside lightly, loosely suspended over this trampoline. Good. Now, it goes all the way up, and in the inner body, let's say I come to the very top part of the spine, which is the occipital. If I take a stroke like this in swimming, reach, if I do it only with my outside body, then what happens is that this, where's my pen? Oh, here it is. This will shrink down to this, okay? And this stays static, like this, okay? Now, if I want to move with my inner body also, then I'm going to let my occipital move like this when I stretch. So it's going to go like this. Watch my hand. Do you feel that up? Uh-huh. And look, now I'm going to move this way, and I'm going to think of this floating. So, see that? So that I'm working from an inner body and an outer body. That's one way I felt of getting to your needs, for example.
I've had a sense of that, too, for a long time.
Yes. Now what we have to do is say, okay, let it happen. It's authorized. Mm. You see, I mean, it's validated. So it's that sense of it. Yes, I know what you're saying, because today, when Ermgard, I had a treatment with her, when she told me, I had a sense of what she was telling me. I needed her to tell it to me. I needed to be reminded. So you will always need to be reminded, perhaps less and less, but that will always be there, does it? Doesn't matter. What matters is that you begin to say, oh, but that sense of that is something I really always have had. Now I will use it. So for a moment, David, would you stand up, and stand up from the inside of the body? Good. And let the occipital sort of float. And now as you walk, only think of the inner body walking. Let the outer body go along with it. See, there's nothing to do, right? There's nothing to do. Okay, so before, do you remember when movement was so hard?
Yeah, there was this sense of having to pick yourself up and carry yourself.
Yes, that's right. And because it was hard, you worked harder at it. But now there's nothing there. All right, sit for a moment. I want to explain something else. When the tension gets laid in, and it gets laid in at all our openings, really, laid in here, in the ankle, as we know, in the toes, as we know, wrists, fingers, neck, shoulders, everywhere. If the inner body is locked down in a physical way to the inside of the outer body, then there's no way that those, that pollution of tension has a bit of escaping. So that if we let the inner body, which is this hand, begin to float away, then thought and a kind of physical release will remove that, the pollution of that inner, it has a way of escaping and getting rid of it. So that's what I want you to understand from now on. So that when you take a walk, for example, don't walk far, David, but outside of your house, walk down to the beach or whatever, just walk with this idea of, for example, I'm going to walk with this just up away from my heavy thighs and my heavy hip bones. And so it's going to be for me, there, I feel, did you feel that mind? It's all in my mind. All I have to do is see a picture of my inner organs floating lightly, and by God, they move up and they float to where I imagine it. So when you walk, what I want you to do is to just to imagine, and then look at this. Dave, have I ever done anything?
That's wonderful. That was wonderful.
I know.
I just have to walk around like this all the time.
That's the only catch.
That was beautiful.
I know. So to you too. You will just take that image, and then little by little your body will get the message, and it will just move according to that image. Okay, so much for movement today. I want to get to Orestes. 2 years from now, you will enjoy listening. 2 years after that.
That's a certain amount of joy.
Okay. So it's better that you fail by having a quick reminder of what you need, a breath and it happening, then that you fail in the other direction. If you fail, well, remember, it is only a failure of technique not being solid in the system. That's all it is, okay? If you do the other way, then we have not only the technique not being rooted yet in your system, but also your mind working in the wrong way, so we have double to correct. But people who are watching you act would rather watch a living person than a person trying to apply a technique. So, the reason I stopped you was that I didn't want you to go through a whole speech making yourself do it right. Mm-hmm. That's why we stopped. Now, taking too long a preparation is one, as I say, bad for you in that it makes you, it allows self-consciousness to enter into every aspect of the thing. The body becomes self-consciously aware of being light, the voice becomes self-consciously aware of being in front, and the mind becomes self-consciously aware of, oh, I am now on this land, and there is the castle, and there is my friend. Can't work that way. It's too literal. The imagination must go. Just as we walked before, only through imagination. See, the technique, let's say, of telling you what about the inside part of the body, the inner body, that takes a long time to tell you. But when I say, David, now walk down to the beach from your house and walk only from your imagination, that's like that. So too is the acting, finally, like that. So everything has to be like that. What it does for people who are watching you is you stand there and you take as many counts as you did to get all those things moving, and I, the person watching, think, And what you do is set up in me a negative response to whatever it is you're going to bring on that stage. So the place for deep thinking or profound work is not in the preparation. The profound work happens in our analysis of all the tiny parts of the exercise, of the technique that we're trying to learn, body or vocal or acting, of the deep analysis. That's where we move, hopefully, onto profound levels of understanding. Then we go and move into a very light, one-word remembering system, a mnemonic, which is, means remembering system, so that I want you to take either an image that passes through your mind. Whenever I think about the beginning of Orestes, I feel that he's come off of a boat onto land. You know that first feeling of setting your foot on shore? For me, that to me is the way I might begin the piece. So that you have about three men who have been in a boat for a very long time, and you've all set foot for the first time on alien land. That's all you need. When you say, okay, you, my friend, you do this and such. There is the house. Tell them such and such. I will go behind. Mm-hmm. Take whatever image you wish, or whatever image unreasonably or irrationally moves up into your mind, but it has to go like this. Now, it may be that you may have to write pages and pages of your thoughts out about the beginning of the scene to find that one sentence that just knocks it in for you. Sometimes when I'm looking for something, I write and I write and I write, because it's not the top layer of my thought. And it's not the second layer. It's maybe so far seemingly unconnected to what I'm doing. That thought is what propels me into this moment in the play. And that takes searching for it. But the search happens at home, at your kitchen table, as you write it out. When you're up there, once one thought for the emotional content, for the body, for the voice. That's all. And now, since the mind works magically anyway, suppose you said 1, 2, 3, and you were there. I mean, you might not even have to take a thought. I'd like you now to begin again. And the thing is this, begin hoping. See, when you are well endowed with technique, I will tell you, trust in the technique, it will be there. When you are on your way towards gaining technique, I say to you, hope that the technique will be there.
Faithful old friend, your goodness to me is beyond question. Listen, and I'll tell you what I have decided, and if I'm off the mark, correct me.
Oh, that's great.
When I went to learn from the Pythian oracle how I was to punish my father's murderers, the reply was that I was to go alone, without men or arms to help me, and by stratagem exact the just penalty of death. This was the divine command. And our plan then must be for you to take an opportunity of entering the house, find out what's going on inside, and bring us word. Spin a tale that you're a visitor from Phocis, sent by Pantheus, he's a great ally of yours. Tell them that Orestes is dead. Take your oath on it. Some accidental death, say, a fall from a chariot at the Pythian games, or some such story. Meanwhile, Pylades and I will go and visit my father's grave as the gods have ordered, with libations and a lock of hair. And then we'll come back, with that vessel of beaten bronze that we have hidden in the wood, and deceive them with the comfortable assurance that my body has been burnt to ashes and is no more. An ill omen, that. No matter if a pretended death will bring me true life and glory, I call no omen bad that leads to advantage in the end. I've heard stories of sages who have been reputed dead and then have returned home again to be held in new and greater honor. So I am confident that from this forged death I shall rise again like a new star and dazzle my enemies. May the land of our fathers and the gods that guard the land receive me and prosper the journey I have made. May the house of my fathers receive me, for whose sake I am sent by the gods to cleanse and purify it. Let me not be sent away unsatisfied. Give me my birthright, my possessions, and my home. No more words. We'll leave you to your task, old friend. Now's the time. And time is the umpire in all human business.
Did you feel good?
Yeah, I felt good.
Do you like yourself?
Yeah.
I do too.
Good, good.
Yeah, yeah. Good. Okay. Oh, wow, I thought we'd never get there.
It's like the hands on the hip.
Sure, that's fine. I like it fine. And you even took them down well, you know. I mean, I didn't feel that you were deliberating them. They were fine. This is what was good about it. Now what we have to add something to it, David. What was good was that almost for the first time since we've been working on the Shakespeare or on the Orestes, were you real in terms of body and voice or speech? You were real. Sure, there are corrections. I'm not going to bother with the corrections today. I want to get at something else. So we've got that, and you were real because you said, okay, this is all I've got, and I'm moving into it. And somehow you gave that 1, 2, 3, and you were there. And did you feel how good the voice was, mm-hmm. and how human? You were a human being talking. Now, as I watched that, now let's go into acting, the emotional qualities of it. I think what it is this. In modern plays, when we are deeply moved by something, when we have a strong emotion, the modern playwright goes straight to that emotion and does nothing but that. He says, listen, I've come here because I want to tell you this, and my mother did this, and your father did this, and my sister did that. It's totally centered on the thing that's bothering you at the moment. When you get Shakespeare or the Greeks, what they do, they allow for other sentences to be placed within the speech that has all the emotional content. And I think this is what's throwing you for now. Let me see if I can explain it better. Wait. You see, in the Orestes thing, when you say, faithful old friend, so and so forth, you are here on soil and I want you to go to them, it's as though you're not dealing with the real thing at hand, you know, the deep, powerful emotion that is going through your body, because you have so many things to do. And look how much you even cut out of it. So you're telling him, say something about my death, make up a thing, tell them that you come from Phocis, the king is a friend of theirs. You see, all of those things are taking you away from the emotion that brought you to those shores in the first place. Am I making sense?
Sure.
So that when you turn and say, I went to the Pythian Oracle, when I went to the Pythian Oracle, and there I was told that I must come back and avenge my father. By doing that, what happened was you got busy in telling the story and you forgot why you're telling that story.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You see? So what you've forgotten now is this, that there is the mankind's most terrifying dream underneath these words, which is what, to kill your mother or to kill your father. I mean, this is, you know, this is that what, that Oedipian dream that we have, or to sleep with my mother, you know, these, it's a taboo thing. So what happens is that because you have to tell him, you do this, and I went to the oracle 10 years ago, and my friend and I will do that, you're forgetting the terrible, inhuman thing that you are going to do. You're going to break the taboo. You are going to kill your mother and her lover. Because that is the only way that you can avenge your father. You are caught in a paradox. You're breaking the taboo by killing your mother, but you will break the law by not avenging your father. And that's what this is all about. So this time, I'd like you to get up without words, David, and I just want you to walk on, and I want you to look at the castle and play a movie in your mind. See your mother in there and picture her in bed with Aegisthus. And then I want you to look around you and see whether you can remember anything of your youth. Then I want you to listen for sounds of Aegisthus coming back, because I think he went out of town and he's on his way back with his soldier. Listen for sounds. And then I want you to look for your sister. Okay? And I want you to do that just standing up there. So walk from the wooden part of the floor onto the rug, and that will be the shore. I want you to pray silently. Kneel and pray. Nobody's around. Just pray that you can carry it out. Good. And now I want you to leave and walk away from that land, and I want you to call your two companions up, and when you do, come back and tell them the words of this scene.
Faithful old friend, your goodness to me is beyond question. Listen, and I'll tell you what I have decided, and if I'm off the mark, correct me. When I went alone from the Pythian Oracle how I was to punish my father's murderers, the reply was that I was to go alone, without men or arms to help me, and by stratagem exact the just penalty of death. This was the divine command. Our plan then must be for you to take an opportunity of entering the house, find out what's going on inside, and bring us word. It's been a tale that you're a visitor from Phocis, sent by Pantheus. He's a great ally of theirs. Tell them that Orestes is dead. Take your oath on it. Some accidental death, say. A fall from a chariot at the Pythian Games or some such story. Meanwhile, Pylades and I will go and visit my father's grave as the god has ordered, with libations and a lock of hair. And then we'll come back with that vessel of beaten bronze that we've hidden in the wood, and deceive them with the comfortable assurance that my body has been burned to ashes and is no more. An ill-omened action. No matter if a pretended death will bring me true life and glory. I call no omen bad that leads to advantage in the end. I've heard stories of sages who've been reputed dead, and then have returned home again to be held in new and greater honor. So I am confident that from this forged death I shall rise again like a new star and dazzle my enemies. May the land of my fathers and the gods that guard the land receive me and prosper the journey I have made. May the house of my fathers receive me, for whose sake I am sent by the gods to cleanse and purify it. Let me not be sent away unsatisfied. Give me my birthright, my possessions, and my home. No more words. We'll leave you to your task, old friend. Now's the time. Time is the umpire in all human business. That was such a good exercise.
Oh my God. Wasn't that good?
That was such a good exercise.
Oh, bless your heart.
That's it. Oh, I had such a strong sense of it.
Yes, you really did. Okay. Now, if I could see that tomorrow, I'd say, well, we're getting there. It makes one want to cry or laugh or something. Not applaud, no. We're too professional for that. What is in my mind is this. I'll kill you if you misconstrue it. I'll kill you if you overdo it or if you underdo it or if, you know, I swear I will. I'm jumping now because I want to go back to the scene. Let's leave this. This is it. And, yeah, it'll be as good or better or less good tomorrow. You know, life is motion. Where did I read in something? The system, the universe, is heat and motion. So for our part, what we want to know is it's motion. And if it's motion, which we must believe in, see, when we want to own something, then it becomes static. When we think of it in motion, then we don't own a technique, we don't own an art, we don't own anything. It's just sort of a... So it will be better, as good, or less good. It's in motion. So that's not... that we don't worry about that. What we're grateful for is that it's in motion. Right? That's the way I want you to think of the audition. Good. Now I want to talk about last Saturday's scene with George, was his name? Norman. I mean,
no, oh.
Yeah, they're named either George or Norman, I guess. We were both depressed. I was really depressed over the whole weekend because of this. Maybe that's why I came back armed with so much to teach you. Jesus, that kid's going to drive me crazy. What happened? David, put the pillow behind you and lie back. Good. What happened was this. When you went through it the last time, as you began the scene, I saw that funny expression in your mouth, which you hadn't had in all the rehearsals. It came back. You know how I've told you sometimes you go, the mouth gets a funny expression, and then immediately the legs go sort of stiff and cute. This is way long ago we talked about this in the loft, and it hadn't happened for a long time. So I said to you, you've got to tell me, what is it that happens in your mind that makes this happen? Remember, your assignment was to think about it, 20 pages of single spaced. Yes, go ahead.
Well, I just think that it was a complete breakdown in my concentration and fatigue, I guess, somehow. Or boredom with it. Maybe I didn't want to do it again or something.
That's
the only thing I can think of, because it was there. I mean, there was nothing different in me. The only thing I could think of was that I wasn't able to bring myself
really
fully to do the scene one more time.
Or
let things me were creeping in.
Okay.
Because I sure didn't feel badly. I didn't feel anything. I mean, I was really thrown off my rocker with the whole wolves bit, you know.
Oh!
Just knocked me out. And the whole lesson was out the door for me.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I was so thrown by it.
Yeah.
I felt like I was grinding my wheels when we were going through all the scenes afterwards.
After the wolf thing.
Yeah, trying through the teeth, trying to do it. And I was trying all those things, but I only had 85%, and then I only had 75%.
Yeah.
And then that last time, I just, you know, I didn't know when. I was just, I guess, old.
Okay. I'll go along with all of that. This is what I think. See, aside from, let's say, the wolf sounds really throwing you. This is what you have to do. When you're working, either in rehearsal, in the class, or in performance, if one thing goes wrong, you mustn't stay with that thing. You must move on. Here you have Act 1, Act 2, and Act 3. I know what I'm talking about because I've made this mistake myself. I remember once doing badly. I was in something called a chalk garden or something. And I was the young wife, so I was in the first act and in the third act. And on opening night, because it was a kind of a weak part, I mean, the part is that of a daughter who is weaker than the mother. See, what I did was when I played that first act, I was weak. I somehow or other I got the character's weakness mixed up with my weakness, and I ended up being quite ineffectual opening night in that first act. I got back into my dressing room. I had a whole act to think about it, and I remember then saying to myself, I will either, as I've done before, take the mistake I made in the first act and stay with that mistake, dwelling on it, and so that I will bring that mistake into my third act no matter what, because that's the way I'm doing it. I'm staying with my mistake and not with the other possibilities. And then, you see, I had time in the second act to say, no, I won't do that. I will leave the mistake in the first act. And when I come in on the third act, I will act as though that act is by itself and it has no mistake. And I did. It's the first time. I'm one of those. See, we suffer both vocally. We have the same problems. Ruth doesn't have our problem. Vocally, you and I are very much alike. But I think also ego problems are very much alike, too. I mean, you know, you always get these converts, you know, I don't have any ego. It's balanced in my body. Bullshit. It is my ego. Was so big that I was becoming more and more paralyzed. I mean, I couldn't move, I couldn't act, because I didn't know where to put that ego. Same, this is your problem too. So, I think that the wolf sounds throwing you, and that will, you know, it had so many other things mixed up in it. I mean, it might have been something that, you know, we should look at my prank. I mean, let's say it was a prank on my part. And maybe that has to be examined too. Maybe I don't come out altogether, you know, from this thing. But let's for the moment say that it was your business, you see. Yes, you were thrown by the wolf sounds, and you made yourself act through that scene, even though the rage was in you and the sense of humor was lost somewhere. That's ego. See, that's the way you're used to doing it. That's the way you've grown up doing it. So, you know, I'm like the Zen monk, you know, go, hey, you know, I'm one of those yogis. Yes? Is it making sense?
Well, it's absolutely the case.
Exactly. So that, you see, so in a way, I really am, I'm a Zen Buddhist monk. How do you, I mean, I've got that absurd giggle. You know, the monk, the yogis do something outrageous to the, you know, the neophyte, and then they go, you know, that's what I did to you that day with the wolf sounds. So what happened was, one, You have a lot more learning from me to let go of that rock inside of you in which is contained your ego. Now, when you were younger, you needed it. You needed that strength to get you out of where you were into a better place. And it needed that kind of drive, and it needed that kind of determination. What's happening is that you're using the determination and drive now that you needed 15 years ago, but you no longer need that kind now. Now you need balanced, you know, ego spread, energy spread throughout the body. You need a sense of humor for things going wrong. You need a sense of humor and a sense of irony for when someone in charge, let's say it's somebody who doesn't love you the way I do, but somebody who doesn't love you, does something to you. You need one, irony, sense of irony, note to Becky. You need that. Plus you need a sense of humor about your performance being ruined by somebody doing something. Third, you have to know how to deal with that other person without destroying that creative moment in yourself. Right? That's to do with the prank. Now, what you were doing was you were upset by an intrusion of wolf sounds. You held on to that moment of upsetness. You held on through all the valuable rehearsing that we did after that, but you couldn't throw it away. Yes, that was a mistake on your part. So that finally when you came to, you know, the run-through, you were still dwelling on what I had totally forgotten by then, Ruth had totally forgotten by then. You were still staying with it. Mm-hmm. That was the lesson, maybe, that I had been wanting to tell you. So when I thought of why did David go back into all of these strange body behaviors and voice and facial behaviors, why did it almost become manic? I didn't have it worked out as clearly as this because I needed you to tell me what you told me. What I knew was that just as the technique of voice being in the front part of the face isn't really rooted in you and will take a longer time, so too the technique of that ego drive and that tough behavior of, I know what I'm doing, let me do it. See, I'm sorry, Dave, I'm going to sneeze. Something passes over the vocal cords every once in a while still. And it's, I never know whether it's something I've done. You see, there's the guilt. Whether, did I squeeze a little bit, or is it a bit of dust, or whatever. But it incapacitates me. Okay, so every virtue has it's like a coin. On one side is virtue, and on the other side is the particular vice that goes with that virtue, and you must remember it. Just the way I said, remember once after you and Lisa and I had talked, after I got home, I figured out that with every win, you lose. With every loss, you win. And you never quite know when it really, what's happening when. So that you win and lose every battle, and you win and lose every war, and you win and lose every skirmish. Same thing. Let us say that your virtue, I mean, and there are times when I thought, oh, if only my sons, you know, had that clarity of mind that you have, and that, you know, you get out in the world, David, you are not afraid. I mean, yeah, sure, you have fear somewhere else, everybody does, but for the most part, you get out and you say, yes, I can do that, or I want this job, or I can make money. I don't have to worry about making money, I can make money. I want my sons, my daughter, to be able to say that. That is a virtue. I want to knock that. But what I want to say is that the vice part of that virtue, the negative part of that positive virtue, is that sometimes you will drive through a thing instead of being light and have what I call the absurdist giggle, the giggle that the yogis have, because they know that the whole universe is like this. I mean, big deal, so you get to be a star. Big deal. And this we really have to know. It's not that I don't want you to be as, you know, just own it. But also big deal. Mm-hmm. Good. And I think that's what missed on Saturday. Would you say?
Well, yes. This is where I have little sense of humor at first.
Yeah.
I have very little sense of humor.
I know. I remember when we first went into the Shepherd play, and here you had been really pretty nice about the lessons, and I was giving it to you hot and heavy. The moment we got into that shepherd play that first night, I thought, I was afraid of you. You know, I was tough guy. And that took me a whole week. You notice I didn't take you on that first night. Oh, no, I had to go home and think about it. And then when I came back, I said, now, David, I think we'll not think of this as a play so much as this is a lesson in rehearsing. But I did see it. I did see tough guy.
Yeah, I
love it. David, on one hand, I love it. And I love the macho. So please understand that. It has a value. But I think somewhere in you must now allow that little giggle to move in there.
Oh, and I really want it, and I have a sense of it in other things.
Yeah.
It's just when it comes to acting, I guess.
Yes.
Real thin skin.
Me too. I mean, this is why we are so much alike. Remember when I said to you, well, can I give up acting? You know, I laid my problem on your lap. What I know, you see, I don't want you to be 60 to know what I know about acting and that thin-skinned thing and that compulsion towards it. I would like you to know it by 30.
Great.
I mean, don't take too much longer than that, David, because I'm aging fast. So what I learned is this, that I was always also quite humorless about acting. Although we're both very funny on stage. You're extremely funny in a comedy, so am I. And yet, I was extremely unfunny in thinking of myself as an actor. Somehow or other, my life got too bound up in my success as an actress. That's a little bit of what the syndrome is. What I found was that when I behaved thin-skinned about acting, you know, the tougher I was about my acting, the more I hung on to it, actually what I did was cut myself off from the best part of my talent. See, my talent, I worked on one-third of my talent just as you work on one-third of your talent most of the time. When you say, as Orestes, it's an ill-omened I'm going to, at the moment, say an ill-omened comparison, because I don't want to kill it. But now that I'm writing, I write with that absurdist giggle, because who ever thought of me as a writer? I don't have anything invested in it. I invested everything, my life, into the acting. But I ended up so tight that I could almost not act. I mean, when I was something like 40 or so, or 45 or something, I thought I was going to have to give it up. I had gotten the fear and that kind of thin-skinned thing and that unceasing, unwavering, see, straight line. The universe is an undulating line. That straight line to my goal was so intense that my body ached and my body stiffened up because my mind was so unwavering. So finally, I couldn't get on that stage without a sort of stiffness, you know? And then that led to becoming fearful. And pretty soon, I became almost incapacitated. I mean, I have been on the edge of very serious neurosis in my life, David. I am very good now, but I've come through many very heavily neurotic moments. So does everybody else. I think, but the thing is that I can sort of weigh, I mean, I say, gee, I'm pretty good now, I'm light now, I think I'm finally learning it, and I can look back and say, ooh, that was a heavy pack. It was dense, it was a mass. In writing, because I'm light and uncensoring, because I don't have any immediate goals for it, like I've got to make it as a writer. I just don't do that. Really, I am writing, and I'm writing well, and I don't know where it comes from. And Dickie, I someday I will give you the Demeter to read again, because it's much, much changed, really much rewritten, and it's getting to be okay. And Dickie thinks it's beautiful. And Dickie, you know, took American Studies at Harvard, you know. So it comes out of the flowing part of my life. It comes out of that part of my life which isn't uptight about it. that part of my life of which I am still uptight, where I have to, why did I turn it over to you that day and say, David, help me with my fear? One, because I'm very pragmatic. I don't want to be fearful, and I don't want to be locked into this thing. So I turned it over to you to help myself rid myself of it. Let me give you one more example, and that's an example that I had this morning from Irmgard. She had me do an exercise where when I lifted my leg, I lay on my side, and when I lifted my leg, I lifted from here. See? And see, it went like this, right? And then it went back. Do you see what I'm doing? Like that. And I really could do it. I mean, she, you know, I'm weak, but I knew what she wanted, and I did it from the source. Then I said to her, I understand myself. Because I have a sense of weakness in my leg, because I am vulnerable here, just as you are vulnerable in acting, this is where I had it. What I do is I dwell on the dense part, the mass. You see? So when I try to lift my leg, I lift it from this heavy, heavy weight, and then I say, look, I can't lift my leg. Look, David, look, I'm really doing, I can't do it. See? There's a neurosis, there's a kind of a syndrome, a neurotic syndrome. The play in the art where you are most vulnerable, that's where you will choose the weakest part of the art to dwell upon. So I choose the weakest part of my leg to want to lift out of some ego thing, thinking that that's where dancers lift their leg. Is it coming clear to you? Instead of, now I'm going to put my mind here. David, I'm not kidding. It is incredible. So, this is what I mean. In my, when I am vulnerable about acting, I will choose the most fearful part of the acting to dwell on. So I make it difficult. I test myself. I try harder. Is it making sense? When I am not vulnerable about acting, and my ego is allowing, it's saying, yes, maybe, maybe no. Yes, maybe, no, maybe, okay? And there is motion in my body, like this, see, because the universe is motion. When I could go either way with the scene, or either way with that sound that was an intrusion in the scene, or either way with the whole hour, or either way with the rehearsal when I hate the director, or either way with the first act in a performance, I can take it with me into the third act, or I can leave it behind. I'm saying that when we are less thin-skinned and less compulsive about acting, we will then have more choices open to us. So that's what this whole talk is about.
Yes, I when I'm feeling that, or when I look, I have, it's not really when I'm feeling it, because I have to look back on it. When that occurs in me, I immediately get a sense that I've shut out things that are good.
Yes.
And it's just awful.
Well,
and I feel worse, you know.
Oh, sure. But David, you know what? It, as long as we now know it, you know, and we've said it, and we've gotten the crud up to the surface where we can put some cleanser on it and get rid of it, we're there, because I will call you on it. And the more times I call you on it, the more frequently you're going to get rid of it. You're just going to go, yeah. So the next time I play a prank on you, I hope I can think of as good a one. The next time, allow yourself to be annoyed or not annoyed. That, you know, I'm not going to say, you know, smile, honey, that, you know, God is love. No, no, no. I mean, kill me if you want to, you know, want to kill me if you want to, but then put it aside. Or if someone shows you up to be a fool, let it happen, that moment, and then let go of it and move on. So this is what I learned from my student Tian. She said to me, she was only 23 when she said this. That's how smart all of you students are. She said, if you have pain, the pain happened here. Have your pain, but now you're here. It is no longer the pain. All that's happening is that you are holding on to it. So let go of that pain. Because it serves no one else, it's just hurting you. If you hold on to pain because somebody inflicted it on you, at that moment was real. But past that moment, it is no longer real. It no longer really exists. It's not happening anymore. Only the memory of it. So if you think, if your mind is like a sky, is like a blue sky, and if you see in your mind a cloud, let that cloud move through the sky and move on out. So if someone has played a prank on you, acknowledge it, and then let the prank move through your consciousness and then out, out, and you're ready for the next real moment. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. When one hurts you very much, you know, a beloved one hurts you, if you, when you hold on to the pain, if you don't release it, in a way you're hoping that the other one will recognize how hurt you are. The other one doesn't. That person is already into his, her own next action and is uncaring of whether you are in pain or not. See, sometimes people will take that so far that they will commit suicide. Does that make sense? In order to say, see how much you hurt me. But it is unreal because that person cannot see how much. And so this person has to get rid of the pain without help from anybody other than oneself. It goes from the deepest human relationships to a test that you failed on Friday afternoon at school to a rehearsal where a cruel director embarrassed you in front of the whole ensemble, and then you were supposed to play a scene after that. And what you would know if you knew this, if you really knew this, was that I'll worry about what he did to me later, but now I'm going into this other scene, I'm going to play the other scene, it's over. Whatever happened between us, that's over. Now I'm into the next moment. It is a lesson, yes, and it can be learned, and it's there is nothing so triumphant as that moment when you learn it. It's all taking place within you. It has nothing to do with the critic, the reviewer, the director, the teacher, the loved one. It's only an ability within you to remove that pain once it's over. I think when we hold on to it, what we're saying is, see what you did, suppose it's the wolf sounds again. See what you did to me, see how you upset me, see how you spoiled my afternoon. And I wasn't seeing that at all. And I never gave it another thought. I mean, the prank. No. But it's true, I didn't even occur to me. Now about that scene. You know, I was thinking, I'm sure that they would like that little tea table apron, but what I would, if I were directing it, I would want two pins, two safety pins, and a big towel, you know, as though somebody put two safety pins and put a towel to keep you dry. That's maybe a little more subtle than the apron, but they don't want subtlety, David. Give them a tea apron. So tell me, how are you?
Well, pretty good, at least so.